Welcome back, everybody. And today is a big one. We talked to Šarūnas Jasikevičius. Of course, everybody knows him as Šaras, the head coach at FC Barcelona. And we talked about everything, basically, from his playing career all the way to his current coaching career, the transition from assistant coach to becoming a head coach, the challenges he dealt with at that time, how he prepares for speeches, what he looks for in practices during the game, what he expects from his assistants during the game. From A to Z, it had everything. So obviously, I sprinkled in some communication and philosophy questions. Of course, you can expect that from me. But also, we talked some off-the-court stuff. You talked a little bit about golf and what his passion is all about. And it really was fun to listen to. And of course, we finish out with some ATOs. So stay tuned for that. Meanwhile, please subscribe to this channel down here. Press the subscribe button. Also, subscribe to all the audio platforms. Become a patron. Become a patron on Patreon. And I would really be happy if you support us. We have a small group and we're trying to make the best out of this. So support us there and keep listening. We're going to keep coming. Thanks a lot and stay tuned. Šaras, we finally got it done. Almost. We're getting it done.
After planning for half a year, most likely, maybe more.
Let's give what the people are asking for. So usually I prepare four quarters for all the head coaches and we go through all the quarters. And usually the first quarter is about background. But for people who are listening, everybody just get on Google and Google the background. We're going to go straight to the point of the first quarter being about being a player and player experience, then the coaching experience that I split up in three different chapters of the coaching. And then we're going to go third quarter philosophy and psychology and some at the end personal and communication aspects that I would like to interrogate you about.
All right.
All right. Are you ready? I mean, you're always ready. I guess.
Ready. Ready to go.
All right. So as a player, you did have a very rich experience culturally from going to the States, playing in Maryland and all countries across Europe, basically almost. I mean, if we generalize. But do you remember a point of your career where you had your biggest mind shift in terms of where you felt you experienced a exponential growth in terms of your knowledge and what information you were getting? Was there a point in your career that you remember?
Very difficult to say about this, but I know I changed a lot my mentality when at some point, I wouldn't say you're taking it for granted, but I think at some point you're really trying to prolong your career. And I think it really hit me that I just, at some point, probably I was 32, 33, and I had a knee injury. And for me, it was like very important, right? Okay, I'm not doing very good. I cannot keep up with the guys right now after the knee injury. I know I will get it back, but I had some complication after the knee surgery. And from there on, I was like, it really became like a shift as far as like goes. Just take care of yourself like the most possible. I mean, I was always fine. I mean, I was always pretty professional guy. But that kind of like made me go like overboard. And at this point, you know, I was already maybe even starting to think about it could be the possibility of coaching or something. So you'd start to watch closely and starting analyze video sessions and why the coaches are doing certain things, okay, and why is he not doing certain things? You know, you kind of mumbling under your nose constantly, you know, and so probably there was a little bit later as far as for my future goes. As far as the culture goes, I mean, for sure, leaving Lithuania when we were just breaking off the Soviet Union and, you know, the country was in a very bad shape, just trying to get their feet under the ground, you know. And leaving United States and going in the middle of nowhere in Pennsylvania, I mean, you cannot get even like a bigger cultural shock that a kid can experience. Leaving your parents, I didn't see my parents for 9 months. It was very expensive to call. You call them once a month. I mean, mother was crying all the time. I mean, so as far as the cultural goes, thing was probably, I mean, pretty early. I'm at 17.
Yeah, that's what I remember. I left at 17 as well. Did you have those Walmart calling cards that you used to dial up the numbers and then dial back home? Or what did you use?
No, I never used. But I mean, I just had you know, my American family, like, okay, give it a call, you know. But, you know, it was really expensive at that time.
Yeah.
You know, and when I got to college, Maryland was coming off the probation. So they were really careful not to break the rules. So I was calling also from Maryland like once a month, basically. I mean, was sitting in math classes and writing letters back home because I understood how much they would, you know, be happy when they would receive the letters. I mean, think about it, how times are so different right now. So talking about the cultural shock, I mean, it was huge, but I thought I was doing it for the better future for me, and I had to suffer, and you know, it was kind of like, no way, I'm not doing it. You know, I will get through it. You know, my parents understand. My parents were good with it. It was very nice. You know,
I think that makes you stronger. I thought, like, that experience. I remember Christmas time was the toughest time for me because, like, it was the family time, and I was with a different family, which really took me in. But you know, that it's a character challenged, I think, and that makes you stronger in being away, and it kind of prepares you for the future in many aspects.
Yeah, I remember one time, you know, I was 1 hour from Philly, 1 hour 20 from Philly, and the Lithuanian team came to play a preseason game against Temple. And Ilgauskas, who is my best friend, was on that Lithuanian team, Atletas, you know. So we went to see Atletas play Temple, you know, in Philly. And the next day, these guys were coming back to Lithuania. So I gave him a hug, you know, but I knew that he's going back home, you know, to Lithuania. I started crying, like you cannot imagine how much. But, you know, and my family was like sitting there, and we didn't say a word for like 40 minutes towards the Philly. And probably after the 40 minutes, I just kind of like, you know, okay, so, you know, Gary and Debbie, my American family, did you enjoy the game? Like, yeah, but, you know, if you want to talk about something else, you know, like, we will, you know, how are you? Like, you know, we didn't know what to say now to you for 40 minutes. You know, it's like one of those moments you struggle. I said, we'll get through it. This is the right thing to do, and we'll get through it.
Yeah, that's love. That's love. That's basically love. Yeah. You love your family. You love your home. I remember Sabonis had a game in Dallas. Portland had a game in Dallas, and I was like 3 hours away in Shreveport. And like he organized tickets for us, and we drove there with my host brother. It was late game, 3 hours back after the game. You're coming back like 2-3 o'clock in the morning. We're like, he's driving, falling. We're both falling asleep, swerving. And you know, like on the side, they have these the road, like that's the concrete is really curvy, you know. And then it just like, oh, I mean, it was horror. But for to see Sabas, you go all that route. It's something that have to do.
100%.
So for you, as a player, do you remember a time where you were like at your peak, that you feel like all information that you can absorb, that you already had absorbed, that you had all the experience you needed, and you were feeling like you had everything under control and there's not much more that you could really add on?
No, because I think when you reach that point, exactly what you're talking about, that you're already in control of a lot of things emotionally and physically. Unfortunately, physically, you're starting to go down. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to be at the peak. For sure, I played my best basketball in Maccabi. For sure, I played my best basketball in national team. But at this point, for example, I didn't know the things that Obradovic will show me, like some years later. Yes, and my 2 years, my second year in PAO was very good. My first year was pretty good. But I, you know, at this point, mentally, I was at my best. But physically, you already start struggling. Yeah. This is, again, where I'm going back, that my knee started to bother me. And I, you know, I was never the fastest or the most explosive guy. So, like, even I started losing some of that. But mentally, and exactly what the coach wants, the defense that prepares, the offense that prepares, the weaknesses of other teams that prepare, I was already there. Yeah. But a lot of times, you already start not being able to get to places. And this is the frustrating part, you know.
So that's like your mind says one thing, but your body says something different, or it's coming behind. Yeah, it's a crossroad for every player at some point, I think, that comes.
Exactly. It's very difficult. I think, you know, physically, if you get it done, like at that point, if you can stay like in your 30s well physically, that's when you really, you know, are in control of yourself emotionally, tactically, psychologically, whichever part you want. But I mean, I was close there, but I think I was already physically even worse than my good years.
Was there something during that time that you really believed in as a player that you changed your mind on as a coach?
That I changed my mind as a coach? No, at this point, I was already more or less gearing up. Like I was really, like I said, second guessing my coaches, supporting the good coaches always. If I had, I would understand. I mean, as I'm sure they had explanation for everything, the good coaches, the bad ones, you know, it's not really important. I think at that point you already start understanding a lot of things, accepting. You're not so sensitive to criticism, you're not so sensitive to, you know, information. As a kid, a lot of times you're just kind of clueless, you know.
Yeah, but you also said emotional control as a player, that's important. Like how did you get to that point of emotional control? And then also as a coach later on, as we're going to talk about it, also controlling emotions, which you have to show and you show obviously, but you also have to be mindful of the information that you have to process.
Well, for example, I give you a couple of good examples. The first Final Four I played in Barcelona. I mean, I was a disaster in this Final Four. 1 week before, I mean, I would fall asleep. 6 in the morning, 7 in the morning, just everything is turning upside your head. You're so excited, so much adrenaline. I'm talking about from Monday, Tuesday that week, you know, Final Four is Friday, Sunday. But you're young. I mean, the same was with all my European championships before all the finals. I already played some finals. And I was just going into the games always, either with a sleeping pill or without sleeping all night. So later I was choosing the sleeping pill. You know, second Final Four, I mean, it was in Tel Aviv. It was already a little bit better. Third Final Four that we won in Moscow, I mean, I was sleeping like a baby before. So, you know, this is the type of thing. So I was, you know, mentally you already start being, but it's, I don't know how to control it. I don't know how to how to suggest to somebody, no, now go put your head on the pillow and sleep. It doesn't work that way. You know, every person is not a machine. So all through European championships, Olympic games in 2000 or something, like after the game, sleeping pill.
Yeah.
But later on, I was totally fine. So I guess you call that experience also.
Yeah. Just kind of finding the calmness and peace that, you know, it's kind of like, you know, what you're expecting, you kind of know what's coming, you know, like more or less you're prepared for the moment.
Done that type of thing, right? Yeah. Been there, done that type of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It has to be this. It has to, but you know, this was my examples, and it's not like because I was young, I could be fine on not sleeping and so much adrenaline. I don't think it hurt me, but in the first Final Four, I mean, for sure it hurt me. I mean, I was starting point guard. I was not running the team good. Now they show all these games, you know, all the time, classic. You look at yourself and like, oh my God, how we won. You know, we won with the older guys, you know, with Bodiroga, with Fuchka and other guys just contributing. These guys got me to the point where later on I will get other players. You know what I mean? Like, it was good, you know, that you have those guys, of course.
What were some things you were learning from them apart from that? What were some things that you picked up from those guys?
You know, everybody's different. Everybody's different. You know, everybody has to find the peace of mind, you know. People listening to music. Bodiroga was reading Bible a lot. I remember, you know, we were roommates. And so, you know, at this point, he was the best player in Europe. So I was really watching him, you know, what he's doing. So you just tell that. There is no right or wrong. You need to figure out what's working for you. And, you know, for me, it was kind of like also music a little bit. But at the end, you know, I'm emotional kind of guy. Like it was mainly experience, I must say. I mean, I was just better later on, because I've just went through a lot of those type of games.
Would you say, like you said two things now, like, would you say you're naturally a curious person when you observe Bodiroga, you observe the coaches, assistant coaches, as you were getting older and preparing yourself for coaching? Is that something that you are naturally curious about and you see, watch other people to prepare yourself for something and learn something?
Yes. I mean, I always really wanted, you know, I knew that I really wanted everything in basketball. You know, I love basketball so much. I wanted to win. I wanted to be good at it. You know, it's probably basically the only thing that I know in life. So, I mean, well, once you get this opportunity, you consider yourself very fortunate that you know one thing, you're good at it. It gives you good living. You know, it gave you good life. So, like, you know, don't cheat it. Like, you know what I mean? Like, give maximum. This is what I always saying. So, yes, I was curious to see how this guy is so calm, how he's so good in the big moments. Then you watch another one, then you watch, and then you try to study yourself. You know, you try to say, remember this game, I did this. You know, at this point, it was borderline superstitions also.
Yes.
You think about so many things in your head, but you are watching people and you're studying yourself. And I think this is very important. You have to just find out what works for you.
Yeah, it's very individual, and I was gonna ask you, like, what the difference you see, because you saw a lot of different generations as you were coming up, and as you see them now, like, a difference in players. Maybe you see cross culture because you were also fortunate to experience different cultures in the world. Do you see there's like a cross cultural change in generations that it's common along across cultures, like from the 90s, early 2000s till now, that you feel like you have to talk to them differently, they absorb information differently? Is there a difference you feel like, or is it just a normal shift?
Everybody's changing. I think the things are changing. I always hated when older players, when I was younger, older players say, oh, the new generation. So I said to myself, oh, I will never be like this. I will never talk like this. What is new generation? I was always consider myself like young guy, but old school, you know, like everything must be like, you know, in order for me to succeed, you know, I must be professional. I must, you know, I don't believe in miracles. I must work more than the next guy. It's just that simple. You know, and now I'm okay. Now I must say that also things are changing. You know, you're talking about technologies. You're talking about the social media. You're talking about everything. You talk about how easy is, how, you know, international everything is. They were before, you know, now it seems like these countries to some extent are disappearing. Everything is so global. Everything is so international. I mean, it's just like one world. We're all citizens of one world when we used to be focused on like the countries and regions in a way also.
It's borderless. So, it's definitely borderless. Everything is reachable. Everything is really relatable also because of social media. So, but you were a prospect yourself. At some point you seen prospects alongside when you were playing, and you obviously have prospects now, but what do you think is the biggest attribute an environment should have for a prospect to flourish? If you feel like your experience, what's one thing that you feel like every organization or environment should have for a prospect to reach its potential?
I mean, it's, you know, it's so global, but first of all, you know, from the, it's like any other thing, from bottom down, you have to be really into it. You know what I mean? Like, my president has to know what's going on. My GM has to know what's going on. We have to all be pulling in the same direction. It's very important. It cannot be done by one person, I think, is this. And, you know, you have to understand probably where you're working, what are the values of certain situation, what is other stuff. I mean, you have to believe in the young players, but you have to push them. You have to be extremely, extremely honest. I mean, those are the values that I don't think it has anything to do with basketball. You know, I think these are extremely universal values. Everybody knows them. Everybody's talked about them 200 times. I think a lot of times it's who insists more, who gets down to business and is not afraid of sometimes of the conflict and sticking your nose somewhere deeper. And usually those are the best ones, because I think everybody knows what's right or wrong. But the question is how to get there. And if you don't get there, do you just give up and try to move to some different values? No, you just continue sticking your nose in. I think you really need to beat your head through the wall at certain moments, but also be honest with yourself. Is this really working? You know, as a player, as a coach, as an organization, is really working? If not, get together, discuss things, find the solution. Once again, once you establish, not establish, once you identify the problems or the good things, push again, insist. Hopefully you're good enough at establishing whatever. So, you know, it's as far as the environment you are talking, everybody knows. Everybody knows what's right or wrong. Everybody knows. The thing is, are you going to insist? Are you going to execute the program that you guys set up to be? If it's not working, how you deal with it? I mean, you immediately must identify the problem as early as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And then, okay, we have a problem. This is our problem. What do we do? Pam, pam, pam. Okay, go. Insist. Work.
Mm-hmm. Pushing, not afraid of conflict, and being on the same page. There has to be a plan of like a common denominator, a common idea, and then going towards it and not being afraid of conflict. That sounds like it.
Exactly. And I think it's very important to identify the steps, you know, because these steps are like what gets you somewhere, but also you have to improvise sometimes. I mean, the least possible improvisation would be the best, but I think without it, it's not possible. Mm-hmm. Improvising, I'm talking about probably doing something that you never done. Mm-hmm. Like like this week in Barcelona, like we have such a huge problem right now. If you talk about basketball details with fouling the shooters. So we're trying to come up with exercises how not to foul the shooters. It's the first time that I've done it in my career as a player and everything. But, you know, we identify the fact is that we played last couple games was FS. We fouled the shooter 6 times. On the jump shot, we fouled in Kazan 4 times. In the close games, that's really, really hurting us. So now we identify this type of problem. We work it. Last game, Real Madrid, only one junior fouled the shooter. So we're already a little bit happy. But this is just an example of, you know, like, did you do not fouling the shooter drill in your career or
no, as a coach? I would like to see that one.
Yeah, you know, but you just like improvising, like simple closeout, flyby. You would never think the players of Barcelona need to do kind of things like that, right? But apparently they do. But it's good that the guys identify that there is this problem and now we're working it. Imagine in the game against like Barcelona FS at this highest level, we fouled them 6 times shooting the ball when you're supposed to do a flyby and not give an extra 1-2 foul shot. This is huge. So now we're working on that. Can you imagine? This is my example of improvisation, let's say.
Yeah, it's a good segue because we're going to go into the second quarter. Now we start talking about practice, Allen Iverson's favorite part, practice.
Exactly.
But when you feel like you have to improvise, you have to do all this. There's also another aspect of practices and of coaching that I find is extremely important. It's communication, it's speaking, it's team meetings, team speeches. I'm curious, and I want to start with this one. What's the first practice, the team speech like? If you come, you approach, how do you prepare for the first speech you give in front of the team? And what do you usually say to the team whenever you talk on the first practice or before it?
Well, it's very different. It's very different. Every team is different. So, for example, you're talking about head coach, probably,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So, for example, I remember my first meeting with in Žalgiris. I came in and I had to establish the fact that I'm a coach now. But in the locker room, I just were playing for years with these guys. We know each other so well. So I just were trying to be honest. Listen, Kalnietis, Jankūnas, Milaknis, you know, those are like fantastic people. But I know you really well. You know me really well. So I said, listen, it doesn't have to change anything between us, you know. But for 2 hours, don't forget, I will do everything that I need to do to get the team in the best shape, in the best way to play and so on and so on. And then afterwards, relationship doesn't have to change. We're not going to fake. We're not going to run away from one another just because I'm the head coach and you guys are the players. So I remember saying that and, you know, they were like, okay, good, you know, and it started a little bit like honest relationship a little bit. I said, listen, for 2 hours, I'm your boss because somebody is put me in this position and I must make decisions. I will make decisions independently of that we are friends. I'm just going to do the best for the team. I remember I came in the first practice in Barcelona. Probably I said, okay, guys, I said, the only thing I'm promising you is honest relationship And from you, I want maximum, you know, and there is nothing to talk. It was already preseason to be in front 1 month and a half. What is there to talk about? You have 1 month and a half to establish a lot of things. But when I came to Žalgiris, it was January. We were really struggling. And I wanted immediately, you know, to listen. Now for 2 hours, you forget. I'm your boss. Let's do it. Let's work. Come talk to me, whatever you need, you know. And they were, I was very lucky to actually have all these guys because, you know them really well. Very yeah. professional, very, very serious, very normal people, you know. So it's huge luck.
Yeah, very, very established veterans help as well. And yeah. it's obviously like the like you said, honesty and directness, I think, is the most important thing to have, to not leave anything unsaid. Also, just to be genuine and transparent as possible, I think, to get your message yeah. across so that the players feel that you're really coming from it comes from your heart and not from just a written down speech.
Well, I don't think I have a problem with that. So.
Okay, so I know usually preseason starts outside and it's running, it's athletic training. But when you go to the gym, what's the first practice like? What's the foundational parts or aspects of the first practice that you want to implement your culture early and establish a certain kind of mentality?
I mean, usually it's practices. The first practices will really still be something of continuation between the stuff that we do outside and here. It's usually not something very heavy on the body, not easy, you know, a lot of running, very limited contact. We start with a lot of two-on-ones, three against two. You know, you're still kind of worried about the injuries first. I think preseason is for me is injury prevention, is not mm-hmm. a lot of thinking. I think it's not a lot of details. I'm talking about the first 2 or 3 weeks. Later on, I'll go into the details. You know, now it's just let's get in shape. Let's try to prepare our joints and everything to support ourselves. Most likely, you've been resting, so it's very important now to get through the preseason without being injured. Mm-hmm. You know, one practice there and there, it's not going to hurt you if you don't think too much. But you know, we need to prepare ourselves to what's really coming. And almost like later on in the year, it's like you know, you're filling the tank there and there a little bit with the gas and rejuvenating yourself and so on. Yeah, but then, you know, then when you feel after a couple of days that more or less the body is ready, then you start, you know, pushing them a little bit with more defense. And probably 10 days before, I'm already starting to tell them, listen, now let's not run without heads. You know, now it's important to start going to our details, but still the details, I'm not worried because usually those are the 10 months that you have to work them. Mm-hmm. For me, it's much more important what they do to their bodies to prepare themselves, especially injury prevention, especially not to get hurt immediately. But yeah, preseason is tough with us. I believe it's our time also to practice once we get them ready. And we start with basically I have a simple philosophy about practicing. I mean, you practice hard whenever you can. You really try to rest whenever you must, you know, in between the games, and then it's becoming all recovery. Mm-hmm. And so the philosophy is kind of, I think, philosophy of everybody. It's time to work. It's time to rest. It's time to, you know.
I think like a lot of people, and what I learned with the Lithuanian culture and Lithuanian, the preparation, the physical preparation is such a big factor in the longevity of the season, in the longevity of the players during the season. The physical preparation, what the athletic coach is doing, is such a big foundation for the rest of the season. I think a lot of teams underestimate of how important it is to have your juices. Sometimes I remember you also in Kaunas, you did mini camps during when there was a time of no games, mini camps in Palanga, for example, just to get a little bit of juices flowing again and prepare the body for the rest of the season. And I think those things are undervalued, whereas X's and O's and details are overvalued in many aspects.
Yeah. I think, you know, at the beginning of the season, I mean, it's strictly my physical preparation coach. He designs the practices. He designs the level. Usually now that we work so many years together, we understand each other pretty clear. Everything is much faster. And I'm talking about the fact is, okay, today was very heavy on the guy's legs. Okay, next day, let's try to do something different. If it's a lot of lateral movement, then the next day will be a lot of running up and down. So you try to also, you know, understand the player. And the fact is that if you're doing something one day and it's a little bit overload, let's do something different next day. So yeah, I'm really, really relying on my assistant coaches, especially the strength coach, just to, you know.
Shout out to Justas.
Yeah, shout out to Justas, that he will never see this podcast anyway.
So what's one of the more important questions you ask yourself after practices? Like, is there something that you always like have a checklist of something like, did we get better? Did we do something? Did we accomplish something today? Is there something you pay attention to after practice that you want to double check yourself, maybe?
It's constant communication with your assistant. It's constant analyzing. We're talking things like, okay, during the preseason, did we achieve what we wanted? Did we do this? Okay, this drill went terrible. Tomorrow, start with that drill. You know, insisting. We didn't get the job done. Now we got to try to get the job done tomorrow. Whereas during the season, there's so many games and practices. Maybe for some players, the practice will not be important. If the guy is struggling, mm-hmm. You're clearly watching him. Is he putting in the work? Is he there? Or he's just floating through the practice and he's not interested, and that's most likely why he's not performing at this point. Mm-hmm. And you know, so it's constant communication. It's very important, the assistant coaches, because for sure as a head coach, you don't see everything. It's not even close. But, you know, communication. You want everybody to succeed. You want everybody to feel important. But if you're not playing during the game, most likely you need to put in the work that. So in that sense, you're analyzing with assistants. They give you information. This player coming in, this player doing extra work. Okay, you see the player working. Most likely he will come out of the slump. Most likely he will get better. Usually things will get better if you do things the right way. So it's also a message for you. Okay, don't give up on this player too quickly. Give him more chances. Mm-hmm. Let him be, but you know. It's very important in so many games right now. I mean, we have 12, 13 players. It's really important that everybody is ready to play. Everybody feels important. Everybody feels like part of the team. So, yeah.
Reflect and communicate with your assistants just to have like everything covered, all the bases covered. You don't want to miss anything. And that's why during practice, all eyes have to be there. They have to be focused during practices and not miss any little detail. It can't be in their own heads with anything else.
I mean, there's no question. Assistants. I mean, why to have assistants if you're never gonna, you know, if you're never gonna rely on them? A lot of coaches don't like assistants. I like opinions a lot. You know, I encourage opinion a lot of times. You know, probably now what I'm 7 years, something like this. Head coaches, we never did something major. I'm talking about signing players, deciding on tactics before the game. Where I say, listen, man, I'm the head coach. This is going to be done like this. No way. Mm-hmm. I think they will not enjoy it. And me, why I need assistance if mm-hmm. I'm just going to make my own decision. No. So we talk it out, everything, signing the players. If there was a lot of times when out of six, my opinion is the only one. So you're really opening your eyes. Okay, these five guys, they cannot be so stupid, you know. So what am I not seeing? You know, and then again, you encourage again communication. You're talking. You encourage you provocate one another to give information, to give very honest information. And probably if out of six, I am the only one. Probably I'm the only one who's wrong. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's being honest to yourself as well in those moments. Yeah. Talking about assistance, and that's a good segue to the game. Now that we're still in the second quarter, but we're going from practice to game. When you talk about assistants, what's the most common questions or information you're looking for during a game from your assistants? What's the feedback you're asking for maybe before a timeout, whenever you go into the huddle? Is there something, certain things you ask them or you wait for them to tell you?
Again, you know, some guys are responsible for offense. Some guys are responsible for defense. It could be information. I want to run a specific play, but I need to know what was the last time the defense against this player, so I get to choose my offense better. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, whatever stuff demands at this point, you're struggling offensively, you know, and all of a sudden you just say, okay, listen, what was our best lineup, more or less, you know, and you're sitting surrounded by the guys. What was our best lineup that we were flowing better offensively? Okay, we did good when more or less we're talking about, you know.
Yeah.
Then you start again. You take information, but yeah, you still need to make your own decisions.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So like at halftime, obviously it's a major time, and you assess the game. Okay, we're doing good offensively. We're doing bad defensively. Okay, let's put our best defensive lineup. Well, more or less, what was it? For example, last game against Madrid, we played and still Kalatis and Higgins are not in the best shape, you know. So I sit down, I remember, okay, who are we finishing as a point guard? You know, like Kalatis, Jokubaitis, you know, La Provitola. No, La Provitola is really good today. Okay, you know, we finished the game with La Provitola. So you decide that, but more or less, you try to decide all together still as much as possible. Maybe something like, no, you know. And believe me, there's games when you turn to the bench, and as a head coach, you telling your assistants, listen, man, I just don't know who the hell I'm putting on the court right now. You know, but, you know, in 90 games, everybody's struggling. It could be games like this.
Yeah.
Okay, who the hell I'm playing with today? Who's ready? You know,
is there such thing as information overload, or is there no such thing? Because there's like a lot of information you have to absorb and process. But there's a limit.
Sometimes it could be, but usually I like information. I like information a lot. For me, if I want to make mistake in one end, it would be because of information overload. I like basketball, man. I like talking about basketball, like thinking, pam, pam, pam. Okay, no, I don't like this idea, what you're just saying, this information that you're giving me. Okay, I don't like that information. Okay, I'm taking that.
You know what I mean? You're filtering it out. You trust yourself to filter out the information. Yeah.
Well, at the end, don't forget, I'm the most responsible. You know, all the snipers will be after me after the game. You know, when we lose.
So, but it's key, because I've seen it also happen. I obviously have a lot of people I know also in this business, but also when there is you kind of as a head coach, I feel like you have to also tell your assistants to be honest and not to tell them what you want to hear, but you want to hear their honest and true opinion that they feel, because otherwise. They, you know, everybody's drowning together and nobody's saying what you really need to hear.
No, exactly. But this is, you know, the process of the trust. I think it's our second year in Barcelona. And obviously it's very easy for me to deal with Lithuanians because they've been so long. And you can tell that every month that passing, the Spanish assistants are more confident just to tell you whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever. Yeah. But, you know, I also don't think it's right or wrong. I mean, for example, I know head coaches will tell some assistants, man, just don't bust my balls, man. Don't tell me too much, you know. And we're good. Yeah. We're good. You know, I mean, maybe that's what's working for them.
Yeah.
So, you know, some guys like to keep it simple, like as simple as possible. So
let me ask you this: like, I'm a communication geek and freak, and people know that know me, but what I think for effective communication is also important to feel, and before you say something, make sure that the other person interprets the words correctly. So whenever I say something, I want to make sure that the person knows where I'm coming from. And I want to know I'm trying to think what other person may be thinking. So to transfer this to the game, how often do you think what the other coach may be thinking or what he's thinking next? And how do you prepare for those situations? Like, is there a moment, a specific moment where, like, after timeouts, you feel like, what is this coach is going to think? What is he going to do? Or do you just focus on yourself more than anything else?
You're talking about the game situations against the opponent coach?
Yeah. If you're thinking what the opponent coach is thinking or not, or if you make a situation a lot of times,
Yeah, of course. I'm thinking a lot. Yeah, I'm thinking what he's going to come out with, what to expect, what just happened. And I'm thinking, and you also, experience wise, especially in EuroLeague, a little bit closed circle as far as the coaches go. So we already play against each other for a long time. So most of the coaches you already, like, I get to know them pretty good right now because it's been 7 or 8 years. I better get to know them. I know this guy, he will not change anything. So we know exactly. I know this guy will for sure try to change something, so we have to counter, you know, for sure.
That's an aspect of scouting and preparation as well, I assume. I mean, you like experience, obviously, but also you kind of know, but you also want to know how he could surprise you or not surprise you, just preparing for that moment.
Exactly. No, I mean, I understand that. I understand exactly how a lot of the coaches do. I'm saying this guy can come out with something right now, you know, can come out with and put a zone, or he's done it in the last, you know, three or four games that we watch the team play. He's done this. Mm-hmm. So, hey, just a sentence there, mainly for the point guard. Be ready. Maybe there could be a trap, something. You know, oh, this guy, you know, you don't even tell the player. So this guy will not do anything. He just wants to be solid all the time.
Yeah.
Again, no right or wrong at all, I believe.
Yeah. Finding the right words is often a very important. But how do you measure importance of finding the right words, what to say? And sometimes situation will dictate of what you have to say versus X's and O's. What's the value between the two in your estimation?
Timeouts and everything in international basketball is so they're so like 1 minute. They have really everything happening. I don't have time to really be there. Usually I'm like a machine gun over there. Do this, bam, bam. And if you give time, you want to give ATO, you know. But it's really, with me, it's really very little amount of sugarcoating and try to go around. Now, if it's halftime, if I get a dead ball and I want to say something to the players, then probably I will go a little bit more calm and everything. But in timeout, it's like, pom, 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 pom. Listen, they are getting us with this right now. We got to solve it. You're not there. You're not there. You got to do this. But, you know, then maybe a quick timeout play or something like this. But you also got to feel the player a little bit. In this case, for me, was easier because, you know, I was a player myself, so I know exactly what they're going through. I think it helps you when you played, especially at this level. And sometimes, you know, sometimes your patience is not there. Maybe you're doing the wrong. And sometimes you know exactly how the player is feeling. And you go and you do sugarcoat a little bit the situation without being fake. But I think players probably don't like it too much, honestly. But usually deep inside, they respect. And this is what you're trying to achieve the most is respect, at least me.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you want to be heard whenever you talk, but you also want to be true. So let me give you an example of something that I experienced, and I mentioned it before on another episode. But I was on a car wash one time, and you know when you go drive the car into the car wash and you put the car on the belt, and then the belt is going to drag you through the car wash. Your car is going to get washed, and you have to let go of the wheel. You're like, you have to put it in a neutral and trust that the belt is going to drag you through it, and you're going to come out safe on the other end. I struggled. I'm a control freak in many aspects, and I struggled to let go, but you have to trust it. So my question to you is, during the games, when do you feel like you can control and you have to control the game? When is it that you have to let go of the guys and trust them to make the right decisions?
Usually second part of the season, I let it go a lot. I let it go a lot second part of the season. I think I'm really, really like from the moment we start working on details, which is usually like first games, and you're really pushing. I think I'm stopping the practices a lot in the first part of the season, everything. And second part of the season, you're sort of like, even offensively, I like to make decisions. They already know at this point what is a good shot, what is a bad shot. They're also tired of hearing your voice for probably 6 months that already you've been doing it. And you need to trust your process that for the first 6 months, you really did a job. You have a lot of videos and everything. And now we're going into the last part of the season where the freshness is extremely important. And if they don't know at this point, then you kind of a little bit disappointed with yourself already, you know, but it worked. Practices become less and less. My voice is becoming less and less. I try to maybe some days, even if we have just a stadium practice, not even say a word, you know, just because they're already tired of me.
Yeah.
And I don't blame them, you know.
So let's move on to the coaching career a little bit. I have a couple points that I wanted to trigger on or to double click on rather. But you already talked a little bit about the transition, because the transition period from player to assistant coach, from assistant coach to head coach, You mentioned the speech, the first speech you had to give that you, when you became the head coach, that's, it's a challenge. But what do you remember as a first time head coach during the first full season, the biggest struggles you felt like as a head coach for the first time that you had to, you, you really felt like you were challenged the most on?
Well, first of all, by being the boss first time and not understanding the situation, for example, right? So I was head coach in January. Then I was inherited with a team. It was not exactly, it was not my team. You know, and then you have to, in Žalgiris, you have to build over from the players who are up and coming. Obviously, you don't have a lot of money. You cannot compete with the top clubs in the money, but you need to find the players. So at this point, these players are coming. And the first 3 or 4 months, they in absolute shock about the EuroLeague. They in absolute shock. They are too slow, whether physically or with their decision making. And you just need time. You just need time. And people say my system is on the complicated side. It could be. I mean, we do try to have a lot of options and everything. And but you still try to put the options in at a decent time. You know, you're not going to put 20 different systems and offenses and defenses. So I was struggling to just understand, like, what is the best way, really? Like, do I sign like veteran players that, anyway, it's very difficult to sign the veteran players because they all demand a lot of money. Everybody wants a sure thing, a veteran, so they are more expensive. Or do we go there? And we always try to give the right balance and everything. But I was struggling to understand when these guys will come about, you know, and you see that in December they started. Okay, so this was the first year. My second year, I was already more calm that in December they come around. Just be patient. Very important that my president who has good communication with me, he's talking a lot. He's seeing the same thing. So, like, again, what we started the podcast with, everybody going in the right direction, in the same direction. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody's present. Everybody's interested. It's extremely important. Mm-hmm. Not just one president coming from the suite sometimes. Hey, man, what's going on here? Why are we losing?
Without having seen a practice. Without having seen a practice.
Exactly. If you come to practice, if you talk to me sometimes, maybe you will understand why the hell we're losing. So the second, the third year, you already see that, you know, December, January, these new players come around. So, and you know that if these players will develop like you're developing them, they will leave in 1 or 2 years. And it happened, you know, with over the 5 years in Žalgiris or something like this. So like I was struggling to understand, oh my God, like, did I sign the right players? Did I, you know, it was just inexperience. Again, we're going back inexperience. I don't know if I'm doing the right job. And then we were losing probably the fourth year. We lost 9 EuroLeague games in a row. And to tell you the truth, when you analyze it and everything, it was not that much panic because we already knew that we are playing good. Our players are developing. I mean, I'm not going to tell you, it was really tough moments to lose 9 in a row and everybody was talking. But for my side, it was already less panic. I mean, even talking with the president, okay, you know, look at our, this is why we're losing. This is why we're doing this. All these things are a little bit not in our control, you know, injury there and there. Mm-hmm. So again, it's now it's, you already understand a lot of things a little bit better in my case.
But trusting the process, with the experience, just
trusting the process. Sure. What you're doing.
Is there a good, any good way? I'm trying to think of like assistant coaches becoming head coaches, but is there any good way or really the right way to prepare yourself for the head coaching position for the first time?
Well, listen, the thing about me is I finished basketball and I was working obviously for Krapikas. And Krapikas would leave for the national team every summer. So the first 1 month and a half, he would come back like 1 week before the regular season started. Yeah. So for me as an assistant, I had 5 weeks to be a head coach immediately. Immediately I became a head coach. Also, was a lot of sleepless nights for me because I was not sure about practice. I was constantly watching my practices. Now I don't do it very often. You know, I don't go rewind my practices very often. Sometimes assistants, they would show you the clips of the practices that we did good, especially if we're trying something new, we will do it. Yes. But, you know, then I was watching all my practices. see what's going on. Communication. How is practice moving? How is the flow of the practice? Is it intense practice? Is it not? So, you know, you start from the ground thing. And for me, that's 5 weeks, 2 years in a row. I had 5 weeks to be the head coach, you know, while I was still assistant coach. I mean, I was coaching tournaments. I was dealing with the traveling, dealing with practice schedule, meals, everything. I was being head coach for 5 weeks. So for me, it was amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. That's but a good foundation. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So when I went in that January immediately, I mean, more or less, I was okay. I'm sure I'm better now just because I'm more sure and I've seen more things in general, mm-hmm. but that helped me a lot.
All right, let's move to the third quarter. And we're going to talk a little bit about philosophical
No halftime question. Beer? No halftime beer for the fans?
Let's fill it up. So, when you watch you coach, you're watching like the – it's obvious that, like I said, you're an emotional person. I tell people that I want to live life and I want to live whatever I do. I want to live and do it how you coach, because it is a passion. It is a obsession. We can call it an obsession, because we wouldn't do it also in general. We wouldn't be in this business if we weren't obsessed to a certain extent, but you can see it in your emotions that the passion is the minimum thing that you have. Is there a feeling that you feel like that's what the team you want your team to be representing you like is that something that you feel like you want to implement on your team to give back to you?
No, because I cannot tell, you know, I cannot make some players be me, or I will never be them, you know? So it's a group thing. They have to be themselves. I have to be myself. I would look stupid if I'm not myself. I think, you know, first of all, I don't want to do it. I will be faking. Mm-hmm. And I don't want my players to fake. You know what I mean? But I already know when I'm signing with the players, we're still looking for the right balance. We're thinking about locker room a lot. We're thinking about personalities. This guy talks nonstop. This guy talks nonstop. If we get the third, fourth, or fifth that talk nonstop, I mean, I would not be able to talk in my video sessions, you know. But you think about that stuff in a way. Probably it's, in some situations, the combination of things can be a deal breaker. Do you sign somebody? Do you bring it inside your family, inside your locker room? But I think every person needs to be himself. He needs to do things for the good of the team. There's no question. And there's parameters that I will not, I will just not... It must be done, you know, like I said, these parameters, nothing to do with basketball. I mean, you have to act like a normal person, and deep down, everybody knows what is a normal person. Mm-hmm. But I think the player has to be himself. The coach has to be himself. If, you know, the coach cannot go crazy if in general he's a very calm person or vice versa.
So let me ask you this about winning, because I wanted to go shift to winning in terms of like the broader aspect of it. In your estimation, what do you think is the biggest difference between winning games during the regular season and winning titles at the end of the season? What's the biggest shift there?
I don't know. Unless you have extremely, extremely like the team that's already done it and really veteran team that knows a little bit how to turn it on. For me, it's not that much of a difference between the regular season and the playoffs. I mean, I'm the same from the first practice to, you know, just basically, like I said before, you need to give me your maximum. And it's just like this step every single day, you try to gain something. And yes, during the season, it is steps where you're taking two steps back, and this, I'm sure there's some certain circumstances why it's happening, but I believe in gaining this, and hopefully by the time the deciding games come, you're ready. You know exactly how to act in this situation. You've been there together. You have the trust that you've been there together. And those are important things.
And so what you're referring to, and I know what you mean, because we've talked about it before, is percentages. Because the percentages you add throughout the season, they add up to winning a title. That's what you're referring to. Can you give some examples of what are certain things, maybe even off the court, on and off the court, that you feel like are essential to building a championship caliber team?
I mean, you know, these are the things that we're talking one more time. It has nothing to do with basketball. You know, I'm talking about togetherness and really pulling for one another, but in a real way, you know, building the trust and having a good locker room, having liking one another, making an effort for one another, being together, family atmosphere. I mean, it's so many of those things. And this is, for me, is nothing to do with the basketball. Mm-hmm. Because at the end, yes, everybody will try. I mean, you try to have as many people who care. Obviously, everybody must care, but I don't know. Not always it will be your team. Maybe you inheriting the teams. It's really complex, this situation. But I mean, discipline, it's extremely important for me, for example.
But like meals, like you said, traveling, controlling the travel and controlling meals, controlling they, like, obviously you have to trust the doctors as well. You gather the information that's needed, but all those things add up to 100% championship team. And then you want to give yourself the best shot possible. So even if a 1-2% chance of rebounding the ball for a player who's going to improve by 2% and is going to make a shot, one shot more, it's going to help at the end of the season. So I think those things are very, very important to understand, that building a culture of success depends on the percentages you gather throughout the season.
I think so also. It's not, there are no miracles. I don't think that you're going to come and you're going to play all of a sudden amazing basketball. I mean, it's just what you implement every single day. I mean, you know, it's just like we said, it's there, whatever you want to call it, 0.5%, 0.25%, whatever. Hopefully, like you said, hopefully at the end of the year, those things will turn out to be 100 or at least more than your opponent.
Yeah. How important is it to admit to mistakes from your experience?
I mean, it's crucial. Mm-hmm. It's crucial. If I'm asking the players, I always have the, you know, I know I'm repeating myself with the players, always say, listen, you are people, you're going to make mistakes. Make sure just don't make it two in a row, the same one. Make sure, you know, if your third one, are you crazy? You in the level, at this level, you cannot make the third mistake like this. Obviously, it's substitution and everything, but everything for me, of course. But also, the only people who can tell you about your mistakes, obviously, media, most of them not really qualified, most of them, and your assistants. Mm-hmm. Your assistants. I mean, maybe sometimes in my case, you know, you speak a lot about with GMs and stuff like this, because I have GM, I have the boss of the section who were ACB players, you know, Navarro, much more than that, you know. So these guys seen also a lot of situation. And you talk. I mean, you talk after the game, you go for dinner. Most of the time, chances are we will talk about basketball, you know.
Yeah.
You talk, you discuss.
It's like it has to be an environment of trust where you can trust each other, that it comes from a good place, that you admit to a mistake and it's not going to be held against you. Like you have to, there has to be a mutual trust and a mutual belief that it's going the right direction, but everybody makes mistakes.
Exactly. And you know, and the worst thing that your workers will say about you or feel about you is probably, man, he don't listen to shit. You know, I think this is the worst thing. If you have this type of relationship with your people, like, really, for me, it would hurt. You know, like I said, I don't fake about my relationship with my staff. It's extremely important, but they also, I mean, they have to be ready to give honest information, like we already spoke about.
Mm-hmm. Pressure. I remember you talked about pressure before, and we're not talking about life pressure, because we, as you said in the press conference one time, I remember that this is like what we're living is different. That's not comparable to real life pressure. But is there a way of practicing pressure to prepare for the pressure moments in real life, in real games, title games? Because there is coaches that believe that you can practice pressure throughout the season to prepare for the moment as much as, again, percentages. You can prepare them to a certain percent, but not fully for the moment, that moment of truth that comes in the final. That's you can't be prepared for that besides experience.
Yes. Well, I just told you how my first Final Four experience was. I think for sure. I think you try to talk about things as much as possible. And most likely, especially with the young guys, the first thing you say, it will not work out. Then you continue repeating. Then he's coming back into the second time in the same situation. And like you're saying, the percentage is already going to go up for sure. And the third time he's in that position, and the fourth and the fifth and everything. And you going through that is already a trust factor. Yes, we already been there. We spoke about it. But if you leave it, I mean, you have to work at it. You cannot leave it. And, you know, you cannot leave it and the things will take their own course. They will take care of themselves. No way. Mm-hmm. I don't believe in that at all. I think you need to talk about it, even the pressure. Deal with it, bet. I don't know how. This is up to you. This is personal. I'm not going home with you at the end of the night. I don't know if you're crying at home, if you're watching videos, whatever. But listen, from my point, you have to do more this. You have to focus this. Again, it's a little bit universal, but chances are if you deal with it second time, he remembers, he gets better the third time there. So insist. Mm-hmm. I don't see any other way. There is no magic.
All right. Luckily, I don't have a horn here for the listeners, and we're going to the fourth quarter. We're going strong. What does golf do for you? What does it provide you with?
Just a different type of competition, a way to disconnect. People have summer houses. I don't have a summer house. I have golf is this for me. I love the sport. It's the sport that absolutely drive me crazy. All the golfers will understand what it means. Golf meaning the one day you are coming and everything is working and you're so amazing, and the next day you can barely make the contact with the ball. It's there is no other sport like this. There mm-hmm. is no other sport. I think it's just on so many. It's the most challenging thing. One of the most challenging things I've ever done. Maybe that's why it's driving me crazy. But mostly it's my way to disconnect. I love golf. I like the lifestyle of golf. I like to sit after with friends, you know, in the nature, looking over beautiful golf courses and have a beer and disconnect. And it's for sure a disconnection factor from the stress and being in the nature, being in fresh air, but it's also competition. You know, we talk trash with the buddies. There's some bets going on. There's fun. And golf course is one place when I'm pulling up, you cannot imagine still to this point how happy I am pulling in the parking lot of the golf. I went this morning, I'm looking at this parking lot like it's, I don't know, like for the kids when they go to Legoland or something like this. You know, it's still the same feeling. If I go tomorrow golf, I will pull up into the parking lot. I'll be the happiest person in the world. I swear to you, it's something so, I don't know, weird.
It helps you take an edge off, I guess. I mean, it's also a form of meditation, I assume, because you're also very, very immersed in the sport, and you have to focus. You focus on one thing, and you know it's
yes,
it's
but also, you know, I will give a quote from Michael Jordan. I remember him talking about golf, and it's so true what he said. He said, listen, if I'm struggling in basketball, what I'm going to do is I have ability to start just playing harder, defense, running, outside, go for the rebound, everything. In golf, you cannot try harder. Like, you need to fix your mental brain. You need to forget about the last shot, and you need to focus somehow. You need to understand these millimeters that you hold in the club or something. But you cannot just all of a sudden start, oh, I'm going to hit now so hard, it's going to be good. No. So it's totally like controlling inner you, like controlling your emotions, controlling, you know, it's this sport is weird, man. It drives me crazy. That's why probably I love it.
Is there a perfect balance between life and basketball? Is there something that, I mean, it's probably not, there's not no perfect balance, because it's probably not really, success is probably not really attainable with the perfect balance between life and basketball, because otherwise it's like you'd be 50-50. It's not really healthy.
Yeah, I mean, sure you're trying to find the balance, you know, between that, the family and everything. My wife is sitting close to me, so I cannot talk too much, you know, about... No, but, you know, obviously family life is extremely important. There is too much pressure. I don't understand how people saying that I don't bring my work home. I'm saying you're so full of shit, most likely. I mean, every coach is bringing his job home and don't ask me, or you are just too cool for everything then, in my opinion. You know, these coaches, they say, no, I don't think about it at home. I don't, what? I mean, days off, we're watching 3-4 basketball games. This is my day off, you know, when it goes. Okay, exactly. If it's not dinners, if it's not movie theaters, yes, that you try to do it.
I think it's lifestyle.
My wife is making faces now.
Tell her I said hello.
Ben is saying hello to you, Anna.
how is the, because I know you work out. Do you work out before on game day or before every practice to get your blood flowing? How important is that to you to have a workout schedule?
I work out every morning, so I can, you know, on the game day, I work out every morning, so I kind of waste my energy, and then I don't argue with the referees or something, but obviously this stuff is not working very good for me. I really try. There's somebody who says that I am calmer, which is, I don't know if they're just trying to be cool with me or if it's true. Yeah, I mean, workouts, I try to do it as much as possible. Yeah, running outside, I like, it's another way, you know, like golf, usually the morning of the games, when we outside, we run. Some guys, sometimes it's 2-3, sometimes we could go up to 4, you know, and try to get a workout in. Started to breathe a little bit more. Everybody's emphasizing the breathing and everything during the games, especially when I go crazy. I just, you know, I'm mumbling there under my nose. Just calm down. Take a couple deep breaths. Take a couple deep breaths.
Through your nose. It's
important.
Yeah, nose breathing.
Yeah. Even today, my son, during the golf, he said, I started thinking about breathing. That's what they told me in school. You know, he's turning 10 tomorrow. And I'm like, what? You're 10 years old. You're talking about breathing techniques? I'm like, what is wrong with you, man? Just worry about, you know, like I said one more time, some Lego or something, you know.
Generation change. Yeah. There you go. That's an example of generation change. A sophisticated youth.
I'm like, what? You were talking about breathing? I said, what are you talking about?
Are you ready for my ATOs?
Sure.
I got some quick hitters for you. I'm drawing up, but it's more of like, I'm not gonna interfere, and you're just gonna shoot your shot that I draw up for you.
Okay.
All right. Top three most inspirational people in your life?
Jordan. I don't know who else would be. Learned a lot from Obradovic, for sure, especially now that I'm coaching. But you need to find examples everywhere. So cannot maybe tell you now top three, but you need to find examples everywhere. I think you need to learn from every day, from whatever.
Biggest lesson from Željko?
Probably about managing the groups and dealing with the presidents. He had some good stories, how to deal with it. How he tells some good stories, how not to back down from anything, how difficult the situations are. Some good examples he gave me now. I don't want to share them, but you know, there were some tough ones, and wow. Mm-hmm.
A favorite failure in your, what that you learned from the most? What's the favorite failure you can look back on? It still hurts probably, but something that you feel like that you can cherish.
I mean, my biggest failure, but I mean, talking about, you know, a lost game, probably it's, you know, it's, I learned a lot from semifinal in Athens in 2004. It's my biggest loss to Italy. You know, we had a great team. States brought not so good team to 2004 Olympic Games, and so it was semifinal against Italy. And I learned a lot from everything. I learned how we were approaching everything before the whole Olympic Games. I learned a lot what coach was saying after the game. Not necessarily, you know, a lot of these things were negative. Learning. So I remember Aval, when I'm thinking about this game, a lot of things not to do, especially right now as a coach, but I'm talking about three major things, talking tactically, preparation, after dealing with the situation that, I learned a lot from that game, and it's my toughest loss for sure in my career.
One skill you wish you had?
Patience. I mean, I do. I mean, it's not possible to get places without that. I just think in my case, you just need more and more.
Biggest pet peeve as a coach?
Biggest what?
Pet peeve. For me, like just an example, for me as a coach, biggest pet peeve is like a phlegmatic person, that a player who's falling asleep walking, for example. I get pissed. A pet peeve of mine in personal life is a wobbly coffee table when I walk into cafe. I get like a drama queen if I have a wobbly table. I get pissed off. So it's as a coach,
I think for me, the coach that says, this is not important. You know what I mean? This is not important. We're good. Don't worry. We okay. Like it's not going to come up. And then when it comes up, you kick yourself in the ass like, uh-oh, like I was warned. So for me, probably would be this, you know, again, you are just throwing stuff at me so fast right now. I need to take a time out and think a bit more. But out of top of my head, I never liked the coaches were like, this is not important. No. As a coach, and the players smell your bullshit. Mm-hmm. And this is the worst. You know, again, you are losing respect of your players. This is the most important. They must not like you. They must respect you. This is the most thing. But for me, I try to not to be like this. You know, like everything is important, every detail. No, if this come around, you know, sometimes I say this is not important. Maybe if we're playing, with our schedule, we had sometimes 4 games in 7 days. So maybe I would not say to my assistants that this is not important, but listen, let's just ride without it, because I don't want to like overload my players with information, because I already know that they're extremely tired. So let's just try to keep them as fresh as possible. So in these situations, we decide, we choose the information intake that the players can take. But, you know, I think everything is important. I hated the coaches were like,
If you had to teach a class tomorrow in basketball, what would the class be about?
Not about basketball. About values, about important play. Again, the things that have nothing to do with basketball. I would start there 100%. For me, the majority of things, it's not about basketball. Effort, togetherness, whatever you want to call those so-called cliches. But again, you really need to insist on those things, because then they help you to get through the tough moments. Because when you're in a good moment, everybody's happy, everybody's flowing, everybody's smiling. But, you know, only the strong ones, the tough ones, the smartest ones, the patient ones come out through in the tough moments and help you go. So if I have to teach the thing about basketball, I would start with things far from basketball.
When do you know you're pushing yourself too much?
I don't know this. The thing, again, just without thinking, the answer comes for me from last year in Barcelona. I was after the last game, we beat Madrid in the final to win the series, you know, and I was just in shock. I mean, I was so drained that I've never been like this in my life. I don't remember this feeling. We were speaking inside the family about it last year, how much drained it was. I mean, so you knew that I overpushed myself. I don't know about the players. If I overpushed them, it would be good to also ask them a little bit. But I was lost. I was drained after the year. But I was never like this. Not after, you know, even major championships or seasons and everything as a player, as a coach that I've dealt with. Last year was very bad. And I don't know. Hopefully I can learn something from this.
When do you know you're pushing your team too much?
When a little bit of the fighting starts. I mean, the players know that they can respond to me and everything. But sometimes you see that there's like 3 or 4 of them coming. I felt a couple times, you know, so maybe you're doing it a little bit too much. Then you go, you see me, Benas?
Yep.
Oh, yeah. Then I go to analyze, you know, why they are responding to me. Then we talk it out with the staff. if they are responding and pushing me in the things maybe that will help me to be a better coach, let's say some kind of details and everything, I will happily take it. But, or, you know, or at some point, maybe you just think that they are tired. But again, don't let it go. Analyze it. Analyze yourself and analyze them, you know, because if they are using something as an excuse, then it's a problem. But maybe I push them too much. So take a step back. You know, but again, you're not the only one. That's why you have your staff. Inside your staff is doctors, everything. And a lot of times after the games, we come and we, you know, we talk and we have the staff together and we share a beer. And a lot of things, you just start talking. And I think those talks are very, very important.
Did I push you too much?
No. Usually when I start talking about basketball, I don't shut up.
That's good. I don't either. I mean, we we're on the right channel here. But I want to finish up with one passage from your boy.
Okay. Sir All Alex.
Right. Sir Alex Ferguson. So this is another classic. I'm going to read a book to you, Charles. So,
oh, this is the first time.
Yeah, this is the first. Don't fall asleep. It's not a good night story. This passage is more because we're thinkers. We think ahead. We're always thinking. And this, I found this passage fitting because it's also about media and it's about thinking ahead. So just let me see if I can correctly read all this. Before I went through the door to face the world, he's talking about facing the media. I trained myself, prepared myself mentally. Experience helps. I reached a point in my Friday press conference where I could see the line a journalist was pursuing. Sometimes they agreed a party line, telling one another, right, you start that, I'll go the other way. I could read them all. Experience gave me that. Plus, the internal mechanisms start to work faster. I loved it when a journalist asked a big, long question because it allowed me time to prepare my answer. The hard ones were the short questions. Why were you so bad? That kind of pithy inquiry can cause you to elongate your response. You stretch it out while you're trying to think and end up justifying your whole world to them. Now, okay, this is the important part. There's an art to not exposing the weakness of your team, which is always your first priority, always. You might have a game 3 days later, and that too should be at the forefront of your thoughts when being interrogated. Winning that game is what counts, not scoring intellectual points in a news conference. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, he's obviously, like you said, he's ready for the situation. I think also I agree that the longer questions they ask, the more time you have to respond. I cannot say if he's really saying it 100%. Well, I mean, think about it. He probably wrote this book probably after already 25 years of career. So, I mean, incredible experience, incredible stuff. Probably I can believe him. Usually I'm a lot more honest with it. You know, maybe this is not good thing for me as far as the press conferences go like this. But you also have to feel the temperature of the team. I mean, I don't have the problem to be honest in the press and sometimes say it. You know, usually I don't, if I say about the name, it must be only positive. I mean, never I will speak about the player bad in the press. I think the player has to have the confidence that I will never sell him out. But, you know, between the closed doors with the video, you know, he will get what he deserves. Mm-hmm. He will get what the job he put. And again, human side, one bad game, even two bad games is not a problem. I mean, we're human, and now we're playing more and more games. But, you know, three games is already bad dynamics. I mean, we need to start dealing with it. You know, one bad game of the player, it doesn't really it doesn't really hurt me. But that, you know, more or less, you try to generalize the bad things, and the good things you try to be, you know, personalized. How to say?
All right, Charles, we did it. We went all the way through. Game is over. ATOs are all done. I'm washed out. I'm out of ATOs. I preach. I hear it.
All right.
Thank you, Achut, no all the problem. Way. And hang on for 1 minute on the personal note. I have a question for you. And everybody else, thanks for listening. Thanks for being here. And talk to you soon and hear you. Listen me soon. Bye.
Bye.